Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, if the men's Grand Slam title race were to end today, which it's not, but if it were, then it would be won by 35-year-old Rafael Nadal, who earlier on this morning won his 21st Grand Slam singles title, coming back from two sets to love down to beat Daniil Medvedev 7-5 in the fifth set. And more than that, he came back from a quite possibly career-ending foot condition that saw him on crutches as recently as a couple of months ago. He was staring retirement in the face. And weeks later, here he is holding Grand Slam title number 21. I'm Catherine Whittaker. Alongside me in Melbourne is Matt Roberts. In sunny Solihull is David Law. And it is somehow our responsibility to try and summarise and make sense for you of a quite extraordinary night of sport. And we have to do all this, some of us anyway, at 5 a.m. Because that's what time it is, folks. For David, it's a lovely 6 p.m. How does that feel, yeah, David?
The only problem being that I've been up since 4:30 a.m. because I'm still on that body clock a bit. But no, you win. 5 a.m. is the latest in our 952 episode history of covering the Australian Open for the last 10 years. It's quite extraordinary. Catherine, that was an amazing intro. And even though I've just watched every single minute of the match, I found myself shaking my head and laughing as you read that out. Well, you didn't read it out, as you described what we've just witnessed and what it means in the context of the sport. I can't really believe it. I'll try my best to give you something useful on this podcast, but I just can't really believe what I've seen today. I wasn't expecting this, and I would have thought at so many different points of it, from not believing he would make the quarterfinals to not thinking he had a chance if it went long, to him being two sets to love down and coming back against Daniil Medvedev to win in five. No, I can't quite take it in yet.
It's the circus of life.
That is the true. Yeah, if you're listening to us for the first time, if you're a Rafael Nadal fan or whatever, and you've just wanted to listen to some people deep diving on his win and just wanting to revel in it for a moment, and you've searched for tennis in your podcast app and you found us, I really hope you're enjoying it. But I do encourage you not to go back and listen to any of our previous takes about how this final would go, some of which I delivered on Australian television this morning in footage that I wish could be destroyed. But alas, the internet makes that impossible, because it's not that we didn't give Nadal a chance in this match. You know, none of us ever would underestimate the will of Rafael Nadal. I think it was the will of Rafael Nadal that made us give him any chance in this match, quite frankly. But what we absolutely didn't really give him a chance of was winning in the long haul, winning down the straight, winning in 5.5 hours, which, by the way, isn't even that close to the longest Australian Open final that Rafael Nadal has played, which is, you know, that's a whole other universe of absurd. The other Australian Open final that Nadal played, where he had to sit on a chair during the ceremony because he was physically unable to hold up his body, that is what happened today. And, you know, he didn't hold back in describing how much that match destroyed him physically today. I do not know what kind of shape he's going to be in tomorrow. He doesn't, or rather later today, he doesn't know that either. We have, Matt and I just had a media alert through saying that he's going to be doing a photo shoot at 2 p.m. tomorrow, location TBC. I reckon it'll be quite close to the accommodations of Rafael Nadal.
First ever champions photo shoot from his bed.
I mean, that's 9 hours' time, isn't it? And the bloke is not going to be asleep yet. No chance.
No, well, he was in press about, what, an hour ago?
About 2 hours, I think.
2 hours ago. Time has ceased to mean anything. Can you tell folks that we're procrastinating with having to actually describe the match? Because I don't know what we're going to do about this. I don't know how. Matt is such a diligent, thoughtful note taker throughout the days at Grand Slams, throughout matches. He can always be relied upon to document a match stage by stage. I have a hot take at the end of it and I'm all about the recency bias and this is how I feel at the end. Matt has his thoughtful, diligent notes and they're brilliant and they make us all look good. I think those notes stopped after the second set, didn't they, Matt? Are thus rendered irrelevant.
It was going so well. There were notes, there was tactical analysis, there were key points. And then, yeah, just halfway through, I stopped being able to have thoughts, let alone write them down. I stopped being able to process everything. The whole thing was like a sort of out-of-body experience as Nadal was mounting his comeback. And, yeah, as you said, the notes from the first two sets, okay, we can talk about them, of course, but gosh, it just became so much more than that and so difficult to sort of comprehend and wrap your head around that, yeah, hands up, my note-taking process was a victim of Nadal's extraordinary comeback.
It was so exciting, David, that the bloke sitting next to me in the press box put down his crossword that he was doing for the first two whole sets of that match. And look, okay.
It wasn't Briggs, was it?
Oh, let's not get started on Briggs. He's had a night of absolute despair. I think this scenario for tennis writers, for sports writers, is a nightmare and a very sort of a nightmare of conflicting emotions because obviously they want the story. You want the story as a journalist, don't you? I mean, we're just buzzing about the story. It's huge. And it would have been a brilliant story if Medvedev had won. He was going for history as well. But this Nadal story, it's leading, you know, okay, it's a prime news hour, isn't it, in the UK? On my BBC News app, it is the top news story, not the top sports story. Yeah. You know, it's massive. But also, they didn't know the result. Presumably, all of those writers in that box had sort of two separate pieces on the go that they were rewriting with every single point. That is how frequently it was all shifting, and you could almost feel it shift. The weight of everything, felt like it was weighing upon my chest, and I was, you know, at a safe distance from it all. So goodness knows how the players and their teams and everything felt.
Well, I mean, it was the most delicious storyline possible, even before the match, just because you'd got Nadal's whole journey to get to this point. You'd got him able to break the tie in such a surprising fashion at the Australian Open, where we didn't expect that to happen, with Federer and Djokovic, all of them on 20 Grand Slam titles. And you'd got the disruptor, the tennis troll, opposite him, the man who'd stopped Djokovic from doing exactly that just a few months earlier. So it was just delicious, even in terms of the kind of the setting. And I mean, I'm like you, Catherine. I'm not a note taker. I go into commentary boxes and I barely keep the score because I just want to feel what's going on. And I just want to react. I don't want to be too wrapped up in details, which I think can be sometimes a failing of mine. But I decided today I'm going to take
notes.
It's
okay, David, because we have Matt until Matt malfunctions.
Well, I kept the most detailed notes that I think I've ever kept in a final during that match. I was jotting things down, thoughts and moments and things that occurred to me. And I got through until set number four, the fifth deuce and the seventh break point. And then it just stops. And I don't know why it stops, but I think it's because of the awe in which I was watching the tennis match, and that's when just human reaction took over. And, you know, it's funny how when you're describing trying to figure out, well, how do you get sense of this and the absurdity of it all from your opening, we got ticked off by Roger Federer in an Instagram post after the match today, in which in the middle of it, he says, "Never underestimate a great champion." And that was part of his congratulations to Rafael Nadal. And I was thinking, you know, really, that's what I feel like I have done pre-match to this, because or pre-tournament, you know, and probably a little bit of a loaded message in there from him as well. You know, don't count me out yet, because I don't think I'm done. But I mean, yeah, you could write a book about every set of this match, because there was so much going on.
Well, should we give a really tactical, detailed analysis of the first three sets then, folks? That's what we're able to offer you. And then we'll give you emotional hot takes on the final set and a half. I mean, it feels to me like this is obviously there were many millions of parts and subparts to this match. So much to it. But it feels to me like there was a fault line in the middle of the match, and there was before and there was after, and that fault line was two sets to love to Medvedev, 3-2. So Nadal serving 2-3, it's on serve, but Nadal is love 40 down. At this stage, I am in the outer ring of the Rod Laver Arena, having taken what I thought was a really well-timed loo break, but turned out to be a really badly timed loo break. So I actually watched this Nadal save from love 40 on a screen while making conversation with a very excited podcast fan, friend of the podcast, who admitted to having stalked me in order to have that conversation. So I was all, I don't think I got her name actually, but she was very lovely. And thank you very much for your lovely words. And sorry that I was a little bit distracted by the fact that Nadal, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, was pulling off the biggest escape act in certainly my recent memory. I'm so wary of being too hyperbolous, because we are just in the moment. But my goodness me, because as I said to Matt when we reflected on that scoreline, the score was actually a lot less close in reality than two sets to love and 3-2 suggested. Nadal had been hanging on by his fingertips since the first game of the match.
Yeah, he had really. I mean, he didn't have a clear way of winning points, I think, against Medvedev early on. And it was such a stark contrast to his match against Berrettini, where there was such a clear strategy, such a clear approach, and everything about his game was working, and he was just mesmerizing in those first two sets against Berrettini. It was very different in the early stages against Medvedev. I was watching these rallies thinking, how is Nadal going to hit through him? How is he going to win points reliably against Medvedev? And Medvedev obviously has his amazing serve as well. And he was rattling through service games, and Nadal was fighting. In his first two service games, I think each of them was lengthy. You know, we'd played about 20 minutes, and Nadal had been serving for, you know, basically 19 of them. And just to keep it on serve, and then Medvedev broke and broke again to win the first set. And, you know, it was pretty comfortable, really. I was worried it was going to get awkward. I was worried it was going to be another 2019 final situation where it's a match we've hyped up and Nadal's just going to be on the receiving end of a bit of a hammering, really. Now, the whole time it was going on, this bit of a thrashing, really, in the first set, Nadal was at least trying things. He was tactically playing around with his game and playing around with Medvedev. You know, he was using slice balls. He was trying to come to the net. He was occasionally looping. He was doing a lot of different things. It was a fascinating watch. It was like chess, you know. It was sort of tennis chess between these two physical specimens. You know, it sort of had everything to that degree. But Medvedev was just the better player. And that, even I think in the second set when Nadal had leads, you know, he was 4-1 up, he was 5-3 up, he had a set point, he led in the tiebreak. So despite all that, it felt to me like Nadal was clinging on. You know, even though he was in the lead, it felt like Medvedev was the better player, was the one in control. And when he eventually took that second set, honestly, like you said, David, I underestimated Nadal in that moment, because all tournament we'd seen him fade physically as matches went on, certainly in the quarterfinal and in the semi-final. And I just thought, well, you know, if that's the best Nadal's got to give today, it's a commendable effort, because he has put his heart onto this court and he has tried things tactically, but it hasn't worked. And he's two sets to love down and he's facing Medvedev. This is just basically an impossible task now for Nadal. And yeah, the least plausible scenario for me going into this was Nadal winning from two sets down. I just couldn't fathom how that was going to be possible.
But just to give us all a tiny modicum of credit, and still, I would suggest don't go back and listen to any of our preview material of this final. Rafael Nadal hadn't come from two sets to love down as great a fighter as he is in a Grand Slam match since 2007. Now, I know that there are lots of different ways that statistic can and should be read. He hasn't gone two sets to love down in many Grand Slam matches in the last 15 years. But nonetheless, he had not done it since 2007, let alone against the best hardcourt player in the world at the moment, you know, playing in dazzling form. Daniil Medvedev was not making errors. He was hitting to a perfect line and length. It was right out of the Djokovic playbook. He just, you know, he didn't need to go for too much because he was just in control of the match. Yes, Nadal was coming up with the odd bit of brilliance, but Medvedev could shrug it off and go, you cannot do that every point. He was doing it, you know, enough for it to just about be exciting and to be a respectable scoreline. But you always had the feeling that you cannot win a match that way. As Matt said, it's just not repeatable enough. And yet still, the statistic that you're looking at that's doing the rounds on the internet and social media is that he has not done this for 15 years. And in those 15 years, he has been his physical peak at various periods. And by his own admission, even in the post-match press conference today, he is not at his physical peak. He said, I was not ready to play a match like I played tonight. He said, I haven't been practicing. I haven't been able to practice like I wanted to. We saw him suffering from heat stroke a couple of rounds ago. You know, it's not necessarily the foot. It's a chain reaction from the foot injury, which is that he's not been able to practice enough and get in the physical shape endurance wise for these kinds of matches. So that is my defense of our terrible takes.
Mental peak though. Like, obviously it was a physical achievement that Nadal did today, coming back from two sets down, but it's his mind that blows me away. The resolve, the will, the desire to stay in the match, the ability to hang in there and push at the right time. That was just a giant mental sporting performance from Nadal.
Well, the third set was fascinating, I thought, for that reason, because of what you've got to do at two sets to love down. He's gone off the court. he's basically shown what Medvedev has got, which is you think you've got him in a rally and he's really got you because you set him up. There were so many times Nadal set him up for the kind of point he wanted to play and then tried to finish it at the net and he ended up being passed. And I think Medvedev is an absolute master of ending up turning the tables with one passing shot, a few sort of big strides across the court, and suddenly this amazing improvisation low down with the ground strokes, whether it's scooping a backhand down the line or whatever it might be. I think he's maybe the best at that. And it reminded me in the second set, because he created a lot of chances there, Nadal, and he should have won that second set in the end because of how creative he was. He won the 40-stroke rally with that absurd cross-court, short-angled backhand chip, which, I mean, I was off my seat watching that as they just stood there, taking it all in, and the crowd were on their feet. And it reminded me of eavesdropping a conversation many years ago between Jim Courier and Mats Wilander, where they compared notes about moments in their careers when what they were able to do to other opponents suddenly stopped working. And that's what it felt like at this point, that everything Nadal's got has no effect on this guy. He's reached 35 years of age. He's up against somebody who's at his peak and who's kind of better at him on a hard court than he is at what he's trying to do. And so Nadal, and what Courier and Wilander were saying, and Courier used an example of a win over a very young Marat Safin in which Courier lost the first set 6-love in the Davis Cup. And he said, suddenly I had to just abandon my normal game and start chipping short slices, which is not my game at all. But I turned the tables. I found a way to win. And that's what Nadal started to try to do all the way through in those first couple of sets. And he so nearly did it. And when he's 2 sets to love down, my kids left the living room. They'd watched every single point up until that point. And that was an 84-minute set. Everybody had given up that this was going to be a contest at this point, I think. I was going to watch it all. I was going to watch the crowning moment from Daniil Medvedev. There's no chance that Rafael Nadal is coming back from 2 sets to love down, is how I felt, really. But it was very interesting to watch Nadal walk out onto the court for that third set. He suddenly looked like it was a new match. I mean, he had been perspiring in the first 2 sets in a really unhealthy-looking way. I mean, he sweats a lot as it is, but they were having to come out with towels to clean up his sweat before he served because he was slipping on his own sweat. And it was like it was raining down on his toes.
They had to do that for the first time, David, in his first service game.
Yeah, it was. The kids would watch.
The second game of the match, he was requiring a sweat mop.
Yeah, I mean, he would hit a forehand and they'd show it in slow motion afterwards and the kids would go, as this sweat would go sort of slinging off his body. But in that third set, I think I saw something from Nadal that I've never seen before. He's at 2-3, he's love 40, saved the 4 break points with real defiance, brilliance, and he got himself ahead at 5-4. And what happened was, he's got Medvedev where he wants him in this set, and he's got himself a chance to win the set, and he misses what is for him a straightforward shot. And he, for the first time I think I've ever seen, he looks over at a coach as if to say, what can I do? What more can I do? I don't know what to... He was panicking. He was sort of really worried about the situation just very momentarily. And you saw Carlos Moya just roll his hands over towards him as if to say, keep going. Don't stop. Don't look back. Don't consider what's just happened. And if you think of Nadal...
Was Avrasaraki stood beneath him, ready to tell tales on him to the umpire?
Well, I tell you, I mean, you know, it wasn't obviously a tactical thing. It was just an emotional thing because I've always thought Nadal is the best in-the-moment player I've ever seen, of able to put something behind him. But in that moment, he just looked so fed up. But he dusted himself down, and on the second set point, he won it. And he was back to 2 sets to 1. And it really was game on at that point.
And now we approach the portion of the match that nobody really remembers because it's all just a blur of emotion and anxiety and just cook for Matt and me, and I'm sure to an extent, David, for you on the TV. I mean, the noise would have come across, but just cacophony and just the wildness of that atmosphere. And it will come on to talk about the crowd in relation to Medvedev later. Don't worry, we will do that. But just, you know, just as Rafael Nadal obviously smelt blood and sensed the opportunity, so the crowd did as well. And there was this tremendous sense of momentum. And my resounding memory of the fourth set was Daniil Medvedev starting to make, or not starting to, continuously making completely bonkers decisions on the court. He had gone about 2.5 sets without making an error, just hitting this perfect laser-like length, you know, guiding the ball around the court, never really get, you know, the odd bit of rufflement with the crowd, because, you know, there were some calls between serves and when players were, or when in particular Daniil Medvedev was going to serve, but mostly it had been kept a lid on. But set number four, you start to see him physically ail. I think he's just a split second slow, but more than that, you start to see the shot selection just go haywire in the most dramatic, almost pretty laughable way. There was the odd laugh out loud moment from Daniil Medvedev, and just the absolute epitome of brain cramp, I think, basically.
Yeah, there was some weird drop shots. There were some moments where he, you know, sort of had the whole court open and he would hit it straight back at Nadal. And obviously part of that is Nadal's anticipation, I suppose. But yeah, I think Medvedev's decision making was pretty suspect and was indicative of someone whose mind had been pretty scrambled just by Nadal's ability to stay in that match. And it's interesting what you say about the noise, because, you know, tennis matches are so often, you know, silence and then noise. My overwhelming memory of that was just noise. I can't remember there being that much silence during the match, and maybe that's just because, you know, the noise was so loud it was sort of continuing to ring in your ear even when it was quiet. But it was difficult to think straight, and I think, you know, possibly maybe Medvedev was feeling that as well. And obviously we'll talk about the crowd, but yeah, it just makes it all the more remarkable to me that Nadal did make great decisions, because I think actually Medvedev making bad decisions was kind of indicative of the frenzy and of the moment and of everything that was going on around him. But it was Nadal's clear-headedness that was amazing. And just the way the atmosphere in the stadium changed as Nadal started making his comeback. You know, Nadal's shots started having much more on them and started having more effect and started being more effective. And with that, I think, you know, the crowd sensed it. There was suddenly more noise. There was this couple sitting, I don't know, 10 rows in front of us. And at the end of the second set, there they were, standing up, waving their Spanish flag so limply and so sort of pathetically that it, you know, they just were waving it because they had it with them. You know, it was like a sort of prop.
It was an apology. It was so apologetic, the wave. It was, we've brought this, we know you need us, but oh, there's not much to wave about.
But then come the fourth set. I mean, the guy had his guns out. He was fist pumping. He was brandishing his flag, you know, above his head. Just they sort of, I think, perfectly encapsulated the way that the feel of the match and the way that the crowd responded to the match just changed through that. Third, and in particular, I think the fourth set, because even once Nadal won the third, I still think Medvedev was a pretty strong favourite in the match. But it was the fourth set where really, as you said, Medvedev's decision-making, Medvedev's physical state became quite alarming for him, and Nadal was just growing sort of taller by the moment.
And then after Nadal takes that fourth set, they both go off the court, don't they? And there's a long enough break that both Matt and I could sneak out to the loo without missing any of the tennis. So thank you, Nadal and Medvedev, for for that loo break. We all took a loo break together. So they come back on the court and, you know, You'd already pointed out, David, I think all of our minds had gone to the fact that at this stage, it's a mirror image of the one previous Grand Slam final they'd played at the US Open in 2019. It's a reflection, isn't it? It was Nadal that took the opening two sets in that one. Medvedev fights back, takes it to five. And then so often there's that reset going into a fifth set, isn't there? And so it proved in New York in 2019. And it did feel like, okay, everything is blank slate now from this point forward. But Rafael Nadal did not feel that way because he just picked up right where he left off and immediately started putting pressure on the Medvedev serve. He doesn't break, I don't think, at the first time of asking, but he does get quite an early break in that set. And he ended up losing that break while serving for the match. He got to 30 love up, didn't he, on his serve? I'm remembering this as I go, if that's not completely obvious. Matt was counting on his fingers. So when he went up to serve for the match, Matt had four fingers up. And then I think it was a service winner on the first point and Matt goes down to three fingers up. And then it was another fairly short point to go 30 love, two fingers up, and never got closer than the two fingers. Medvedev breaks back. We go 5-all.
That was where I reminded you of Djokovic and Federer, wasn't it, in 2019? Because that's how it started to feel to me. I thought this feels very similar to Federer having two match points.
Rafael Nadal felt that way as well, David. Can I allow him to say it in his own words? Because this is what he said to Eurosport after the match of those sequence of events late on in the fifth set, after he got broken back in the fifth. He said to Eurosport, "After that, I said, fuck, one more time, a break up in the fifth and I'm going to lose again, like in 2012 and like in 2017. Rafael Nadal said fuck on international TV in the middle of the afternoon. But yeah, you reminded me, Matt, of the fact that in 2012 and in 2017, of course, the famous epic marathon Djokovic final in 2012 and that, you know, what felt like at the time a throwback final with Federer in 2017, but we didn't know then what we know now. He was a break up in the fifth set both times and lost it.
Yes, we put that on Twitter and I just got abused. You know, people saying, read the room, Matt. This is not what we need to know at this time. Come on. But actually...
Yeah, Hannah had to follow up with some Billie Jean content to soothe people.
But actually, this, you know, it's interesting to hear Nadal mentioning that there, you know, and I think that's important because the fact that this has happened at the Australian Open, I think, adds extra significance to Nadal doing what he's done here. You know, the Australian Open has been a tournament of real pain for Nadal. Obviously, he's won it in the past, and that's great. But he has tried and come so close to winning a second Australian Open so many times, whether it be injury that's thwarted him, you know, the back injury against Wawrinka in the final. He also had to, I think, pull out of a match against Cilic, if I remember correctly, quite deep in a tournament. And he's also been stopped by Djokovic and he's been stopped by Federer in finals, really close finals. And one of the things I love so much about tennis and so much about the Grand Slams is that we go back to these venues, these physical spaces every year. And you know, the players return to scenes of their triumphs and scenes of their defeats. And that just adds extra meaning to everything. And, you know, I'm sitting on that court thinking about Nadal losing from a breakup in the fifth set twice before in this situation, on this very court, in this very same physical space. And Nadal is thinking about it as well. And for him to then rewrite that story and to sort of put a happy ending on it, it doesn't take away those losses and the pain of all those defeats, but you know, it reminds you why losses are important as well, I suppose, along the way, and why it's all important, and it all feeds into this moment that we got for Nadal today. And he's just so acutely aware of all that history. And I think that's part of what's so emotional about watching him sort of do what he did today.
He's so acutely aware of the history and respectful of it, and yet not that bothered by his place in it, which is such a unique
doesn't
balance.
Doesn't obsess over it, does he?
That's his word.
Or even, you know, he said today, that is not a thought for me at all. 21, the race, the numbers, where I end up in terms of the greatest, not even a thought. And he means it. He really, really means that. Can anybody remember the final game?
What I remember thinking is that his chance had gone, kind of. That's how I felt. I thought we were seeing Djokovic-like defiance from Medvedev. And so for Nadal to immediately create another opportunity and break again, then I thought what I always pretty much think in these situations is that when you fail to serve it out the first time, you'll get it right the second time if you're given another chance. You'll learn from the last time. And that's how that's what I said to my wife in the room as we said. I said, I think he'll do it this time, you know, because it can't happen twice, is how it felt to me. And I mean, he served it out to love, didn't he? And he was peerless in that final game all the way through the final set. Okay, apart from the games that he did get broken back, but I thought his tennis was completely different to what we'd seen in the other four sets. The other four sets were about conjuring, creating, finding different ways to beat an opponent. In set five, he went back to plan A of hitting the ball, but he was hitting the ball so much more cleanly and with authority and with belief that he could stand toe-to-toe with Medvedev and knock him spark out. That's how it felt to me, is that he was just a different man in terms of conviction on his shots, and he didn't look tired. That was the interesting thing, is it was Medvedev who was fading. And I mean, of all the scenarios, based on the days that have led up to this, the idea that Nadal would outlast Medvedev, which is basically what happened in the end in that fifth set, he was the stronger of the two. And I... What a sporting moment that was to see him. And you know, we didn't get his moment of victory on his back. We got a moment of victory, him standing there laughing at the sheer absurdity of it all, looking at his team as if to say, how the hell has that happened?
Then sort of falling forwards onto his knees. I don't know, out of necessity, I don't know whether they actually sort of buckled on him. But it was different to any other celebration that we've seen from Nadal.
Yeah, and this idea of it being the least plausible way of him winning is very fitting, isn't it? Because just as you said at the start, this has been a completely implausible victory on the macro level. You know, he was on crutches, he had COVID, he didn't even know if he was going to be coming to Australia. He says it's the most unexpected victory of his career. And then on, you know, at the micro level as well, you know, even within this tournament, I thought he looked pretty done against Shapovalov. I thought he was very, very done, two sets to love down. You know, all the steps along the way, it's been just so unlikely that he would end up with the trophy. And it was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. You know, it's unbelievable what's happened tonight. The way he has pulled that out is Mary Coelho said to us, it's his legacy match. You know, it's legendary what he did and how he did it.
Yeah. We're still processing, folks. His press corps, I mean, he's going to be still processing for a long time, I think. I mean, there was just this sort of disbelieving grin on his face throughout the press conference, wasn't there? I mean, I really think he is going to win. It's not that he doesn't believe it in a sort of, in that, you know, like, I don't know, like when Andy Murray won the US Open, won his first slam, and it was sort of, it was all, he just looked dazed, didn't he? It's not that kind of disbelief. I definitely think he's going to enjoy it and be able to enjoy it. But he almost finds it funny, I think, because of, as you say, how implausible it is. But it was a great press conference, exactly as you'd expect. And we're going to play you some some audio from both of the finalist press conferences, actually, because they were both pretty arresting in completely different ways. We'll start with the champion. It was Simon Briggs, actually, that asked him in press. He said, "You often say that you have to suffer to win big matches." And he asked, "With your foot and with the time you've been away, are you suffering even more than usual tonight?" And this is what Nadal had to say.
"I was not ready physically for this kind of battles. Honestly, no, I didn't practice enough to be ready for it. But tonight have been very special. I give it everything that I have inside. Believe me, I am, yeah, super, super tired in all ways. I even can't celebrate. but it was the day to give everything, you know. So I enjoy it. I enjoyed the fight. I enjoyed the emotions. And at the end, have this trophy with me means everything today, you know. So I can't be happier. And I just want to recover a little bit and enjoy a little bit, yeah."
Three more in the room. Catherine.
Rafa, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Just in terms of the foot, how painful is it? How painful was it over the latter stages of that match?
Tonight, I was no pain at all. Oh, you know, I was able to, as you can see, I was able to run without limitations. I don't know what can happen tomorrow, but I feel lucky that I was able to play, to feel free to play tennis, to just play tennis, no? And that's an amazing feeling. I know things can change because, as I explained the other day, my injury is difficult to fix, impossible, by the way. but I was able to play for 1 month, and that's a lot. Something unexpected, something that gives me plenty of energy to keep going, and I just want to enjoy this moment and, of course, try to keep going. You know, I really enjoy it, the feeling to be back on the tour, and I'm going to try to follow my personal calendar.
Super, super tired in all ways is a great summary of the post-final experience.
He said in Spanish, "Estaba hecho polvo," which is sort of literally, he was made of dust by the end. It just means to be completely exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, amazing what he said about the foot, though. I mean, I was convinced that he was in agony in that match with the foot. That was the story that I had in my head, and I think he was in a type of physical agony, but it obviously wasn't specifically the foot. I mean, how amazing for him to be saying that he didn't feel it. Now, whether that's, you know, adrenaline is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I hope that he can walk tomorrow. But you know, he's going to take whatever time he needs to recover, isn't he? And my goodness me, we are not going to do forward-looking in this podcast. We're not going to say what now. We're not going to say, is he going to win the French? Look, we will do that. We will get carried away and make big sweeping predictions about the GOAT race and all of that. Of course, we're going to end up doing that at some stage soon on the podcast. It just doesn't feel like tonight is quite the night for that. We have got an Australian Open review show for Friends of the Pod, which will be up in the next couple of days. But still on this show, we need to talk about the beaten finalist, Daniil Medvedev.
Yeah, can I just say one thing more on Nadal? Just, I think, is something very significant he's achieved tonight. In addition to the 21st Grand Slam, he's now got each slam twice. And I think that's massive. You know, I think we talked about it when Novak Djokovic did it at the French Open last year. Nadal's now done it as well. And look, don't want to get into goat debate and all of that. But that is something which separates them from
It feels
Federer
like you're dipping a toe into the goat debate, Matt.
Look, it's almost impossible not to. Look, we've sort of the whole way with the goat with the big three, it's felt like Wimbledon 2008 was the greatest sort of moment that they would have, and then it was the Australian Open 2012 when, you know, the really long final which Djokovic won, and then it was 2017 Australian Open with the throwback, and then it was Nadal getting to 20 and at Roland Garros, and then it was Djokovic beating Nadal at Roland Garros last year, and now it feels like this has sort of topped the lot. We can't, you know, this story isn't finished yet, this race isn't run yet, but so that's why you shouldn't go into all of that. But I do think that is significant that Novak Djokovic and Rafa Nadal have both won every slam twice. Like that's just something you can't ignore.
Well, consider that a tease for future GOAT debates to come on the Tennis Podcast, and wild speculation about what the future will hold for those three extraordinary athletes. Both Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic have done Instagram posts praising Rafael Nadal. I mean, how could you not tonight? So that's a classy move from them both.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Daniil Medvedev, folks, I feel for him a lot tonight. I really, really do. I mean, not just because of the bare facts of losing from two sets to Love Up. I mean, we're going to hear from him and we're going to hear from the horse's mouth about how he feels. And I think on the tennis front, he doesn't feel too terrible about it. I think he has so much respect for Nadal and actually was quite in awe of what Nadal did tonight. I think that will help him find a peace with the result. But he found it an extremely difficult experience, and he made no secret of the fact that that was because of the crowd. And look, we'll weigh in on our feelings about that, but I think first and foremost we should hear the pretty startling words that Daniil Medvedev had to say in press. He kicked off with a statement to the room, and then I later was able to follow up with a question of my own. This is what Daniil Medvedev had to say.
It's going to be a little bit of a new press conference because I'm going to start with a short or long, I don't know, I'll try to keep it short, story of a young kid who dreamed about big things in tennis. So when I picked up a racket when I was 6 years old, I mean, then the time goes fast when you're like 12. I was just, you know, practicing, playing some Russian tournaments. And of course, you're watching Grand Slams on the TV, big stars playing, fans supporting, and you dream of being there. Start playing some Tennis Europe tournaments. I actually remember playing Youth Olympic Games. I think it's what's called like Youth Olympic Festival or whatever. I made final and it was cool. We had like a center court, and I think it was in Turkey. I would say there was maybe 1,000 people, 2,000, and it was really cool. It was amazing to be there, and that's the moments where you dream of, yeah, bigger stages. So then I think the big part for every junior is playing a junior Grand Slam. That's where you can see the pros. In US Open, you actually eat in the restaurant with them, and some small like things like this. There are people coming to support you, even if probably they don't really know who you are, but there are people supporting juniors, and it's great moments. And that's a moment where you're like, wow, I want to be there in this Grand Slams playing yeah, against the best people in the world. I remember when I went to US Open, I saw John Isner passing by, and I was like, wow, he's so huge. He's bigger than on the TV, and it's just nice moments. Then, I don't know, a lot of futures, a lot of challengers try to climb your way up. You start playing biggest tournaments, and there are some moments in my career where I think this kid was doubting if he should continue to dream about these big things or not. I remember one, it was I lost a really tough match two times in Roland Garros, actually, and I speak French. And I feel like in my age, I was maybe top five at this moment or something like this, which is not bad, and especially we have a huge generation, as you can see right now, a lot of top 10 players and stuff like this. And I remember I lost to Benjamin Bonzi, who's in top 100 now. There was, if I'm not mistaken, one Russian journalist in the room. I was like, really? It's a Grand Slam? Or like I think I was close to being top 50, really young. I was like, okay, that's surprising. I think the journalist was Russian, so we talked for like 5 minutes, and I like talking to journalists. Then I remember a tough loss to Pierre Gerbert, 2-0 to, up in the sets. Actually, amazing match. He played amazing. And I like these matches. That's why I like tennis. I was on the edge of breaking top 10. Again, in my age, I think I would be like top three. There would probably be Zverev and even maybe top two. Dominic, of course, but he's a little bit older. I came in the press. I was a little bit, yeah, frustrated with the fans and everything. And so it's funny because I wanted to keep it short. So I wanted to like play, like answer with two words or anything. There was one journalist, I think Italian. He asked me something. I answered two words. No more question. There were some Russians. They asked me some things. Again, a kid was doubting if he should continue of dreaming big. And I'm not going to explain why exactly. But today, during the match, I understood that I'm going to play tennis. Actually, it's funny because I was talking about journalists, but I really like talking to you guys. I mean, I think you can see it. So it's that's not really the point. I'm just talking about few moments where the kid stopped dreaming, and today was one of them. I'm not going to really tell why. So from now on, I'm playing for myself, for my family, to provide my family, for people that trust in me, of course, for all the Russians, because I feel a lot of support there. I'm going to save it like this. So if there is a tournament on hard courts in Moscow before Roland Garros or Wimbledon, I'm going to go there, even if I miss a Wimbledon or Roland Garros or whatever. The kid stopped dreaming. The kid is going to play for himself. And that's it. That's just my story. Thanks for listening, guys. Now we can go to questions about tennis or anything.
Congratulations on your tournament.
Thanks a lot.
How much of what you're feeling tonight and the story that you've just told were you feeling before tonight? Or is it just about tonight?
Not much. As I said, you know, there were some moments of in my career where I could adapt. I actually forgot to tell in my story, so about the kid. So when I also started to get just a little bit higher, like top 20, top 30, you know, start to play Novak, Roger, Rafa. We made some tough matches. I haven't beat them yet. And there was a lot of talks, I remember. I don't think there is that much right now, but I remember there were a lot of talks like young generation should do better, or or there were talks like people saying we really want young generation to go for it, to be better, to be stronger. And I was like pumped up. I was like, yeah, let's try, you know, to give them hard time and everything. Well, I guess these people were lying because, yeah, every time I stepped on the court in these big matches, I really didn't see much people who wanted me to win.
It's a cumulative.
But tonight was like the epopee, or how you call it, like the top of the mountain.
It was a pretty astonishing moment when he came into press and delivered that story. You know, bits of it are rambling and a bit sort of incoherent. He was in the moment. He was hugely emotional. There was actually a sort of an extremely farcical moment for all of us before he came into press. So his press conference was called, and we're all there sort of taking our seats in the room, and lots of the media assistants are handing out glasses of champagne as they do for the press conference of the champion, because Medvedev and Rafa were coming back to back. And they'd obviously not Rick, because Medvedev was a bit late. So actually he was closer to Nadal's time slot than Medvedev's, completely innocent mistake. But Medvedev is sort of moments away and champagne is being distributed. Luckily the champagne was hidden. I think there might have been one or two rogue glasses under seats. I don't think Daniil Medvedev ever caught sight of a glass of champagne, thank goodness. Or they probably would have taken that quite well, to be honest. That made me feel really sad, what Daniil Medvedev had to say tonight. You know, irritable Medvedev, I love. You know, slightly on the edge Medvedev, I love, but sad Medvedev, disillusioned Medvedev is a really tough one to take, and I don't know where to come down on this, because look, there was the for me, obviously I wasn't hearing everything that the players were hearing in the crowd, there was the odd over the line moment with cheering or crying out between serves or just as players were going to serve, there was a bit of that. It didn't feel like there was massive malice in any of it. There was no suing tonight, which was enjoyable. I mean, Daniil Medvedev was booed onto court.
That was rough, I thought.
Yeah, that was rough. And at the time, I thought it was pantomimey. I do think there is a bit of a disconnect here with the Australian crowd and Daniil Medvedev. It does feel different to how the New York crowd booed him and had that love-hate relationship with him a few years ago, and that's obviously continued and become a whole thing. I don't think they hate him. I really don't. I don't think they get it. Maybe it's, you know, the irony of it all, the irreverence. I don't know. Maybe they're just not familiar enough with him. But in terms of whether he was treated poorly by them tonight, other than the booing onto court, I don't know. I mean, for me, it felt like a mostly extremely positive energy towards Rafael Nadal. And I feel two things about that. I feel like Daniil Medvedev's response to it is entirely human and entirely understandable and entirely how I would feel. I would lose my mind if I had that many people cheering against me that vociferously in sort of the biggest moment of my life. I wouldn't cope with that. I would need therapy for the rest of my life, or more therapy for the rest of my life. Awful, absolutely unimaginably difficult. I think, you know, the human condition is to find that difficult. But I also think it was entirely human of the crowd to be willing for Nadal in the way that they were, with this appreciation of the story and the significance and the history of it all. So I think I'm not reaching a conclusion, but I feel for him. I don't think he's wrong. I hope that he will change his mind about what he said tonight. I don't know. What are your feelings?
I feel very similarly. I feel very sad for Medvedev. You know, I've heard his story now a couple of times, and I'm still not entirely sure I can fully make sense of it or really know what he's getting at. It does seem to me that there's sort of three different bits. I think your follow-up question and his clarification there was quite revealing as well. It seems that not having people take interest in him from sort of years back has sort of damaged him a little bit, or sort of he didn't like that. That was a moment where the sort of dream started dying, and then the crowd support, obviously, and then also this idea that tennis was waiting for someone else to come through, or men's tennis, someone else to come through, and he's the guy, and yet he doesn't feel like he's getting the love and appreciation that he deserves, perhaps. So I think there's lots of different factors at play, but just him saying, you know, when I get to 30, I'm not sure I'm going to want to be playing tennis anymore, and the kid inside me has stopped dreaming. Those are very sad things to hear, I think. And yeah, I think it will take a little while for me to really come to understand fully what he's talking about there, but that's my impression of it just in the moment now. And yeah, I mean, I hope some of it for him was an in the moment reaction, you know, a sort of a reaction to, yeah, a very tough experience generally, not just defeat, but just, as you said, just being in that atmosphere was obviously difficult for him.
I felt his reaction was the sort of understandable and honest version of what I imagine was really going on inside for Novak Djokovic all those times he played Roger Federer and had the crowd so against him and so in Federer's corner, and actually probably worse behaved, because particularly at the US Open they were deliberately trying to get in the way. And I think that that's one of the reasons Djokovic has shown his greatness over the years, the fact that he still won and he still managed to find a way and seemingly didn't let that get to him, but I'm sure it did. Medvedev just fronted up and told us what that feels like tonight, I think. And look, he's done an amazing job of being this pantomime villain and taking them on over the years and giving us some of our favourite moments on the tennis podcast, really, with his reactions. And you know, there is a bit of me that thinks, well, hold on, is this real? Is he teasing us here? Is he sort of laying this on? And actually the reality is he doesn't mind at all. Well, no, I think he's found a way over the years to make fun of it all and use it as fuel and shown a defiance. But actually, I think he doesn't really get it over the years. I don't think he does understand why he's not getting the support. And Djokovic has never understood, why am I not getting the support? And then suddenly Djokovic did, when it was him showing his vulnerability and being older and losing. And it will come to Daniil Medvedev in time too, probably, once all these guys have gone, because that's just how it ends up working. But, you know, he did sound pretty crestfallen, and it may well just be an in-the-moment thing. But, I mean, it led to him delivering the most fantastic little troll of his own at the end of his speech, didn't it, where he just said, you know, and one final thing, and that final thing always means, and thank you, the crowd. And he just said, thank you to my team again. And just
it was
said everything.
Sensationally delivered. It was absolutely
wonderful
brilliant.
Timing, yeah. And delivery.
Yeah, and
but
I just,
yeah, I mean, I think it was a wonderful speech, really. I mean, it was all over the shop. I agree, but the way that you followed up, Catherine, enabled us to understand the hurt inside. I mean, I agree with you. I do not know how, even if people weren't like being completely obstructive, and I think he felt they were, but at the very least, I do something great and it's silence and I miss a shot and the roof comes off, I'm struggling even just thinking about that. from his perspective. How do you handle that? That isn't fair, is it? It is fair because that's the sport, you know, and crowds can choose who they want. Oh, my word, just mentally, how do you cope with that?
And I think partly what I was getting at with the cumulative thing is that, you know, maybe you can just put it aside as a one-off today and go, look, I'm facing Nadal, one of the most loved, adored, unique, special athletes the sport has ever seen. But in the previous round, he was playing Stefanos Tsitsipas, one of his contemporaries, one of the other players that has also been bigged up as the next generation, et cetera, sort of comparable in lots of ways. And Tsitsipas had the very heavy support. Now, I think that is largely down to the fact that there is this enormous Greek community in Melbourne, and they're extremely vocal, and that creates a sort of just an atmosphere in the crowd, so that even those that aren't specifically, you know, Greek and cheering for Medvedev, for Tsitsipas rather, you get caught up in it. But that's sort of what I was getting, you know, he's sort of waiting for the matchup, going, okay, well, maybe it'll be this one that they go for me. And it just never really happened. It did it in the previous round. It was Felix Auger-Aliassime who was trying to pull off the upset. They were going for the underdog, this young kid trying to pull something off. And I do, personally, I think he deserves better. He does deserve crowd support. But then equally, I can't fault the crowd in each of those individual circumstances.
No. He was a bit naive, really, I think. Naive that he thought he was going to get the support, I think. But I also feel that I think what worked in New York is that everybody cheered for Nadal, but then everybody was on his side at the end, you know, once he gave his speech. And he never quite got there this time, did he? All the way through the tournament, Correa was trying to give him chances in a way in the interviews to win them over. But, you know, his natural reaction is when they're against me is to sort of, you know, sarcastically applaud them. And again, I totally understand that mentality, but the crowd almost seemed to let take that personally in Australia and say, well, don't you give me back, chat. You know, I'm allowed to boo you, but you can't give me any back. That's how it came across.
I just hope, just hang in there, Daniil, if you're listening. You will get there with crowds in the end. You will. You're too cool and interesting and funny and all the rest of it not to. He'll get there. Just please don't lose the faith.
We need you, Daniil.
We need you, Daniil. Tennis needs you, I think. And look, we are going to revel in the joy of these extraordinary, legendary athletes at the top of the sport for as long as we can. But they won't be around forever. They probably won't be around for much longer. And we really will need Medvedev and the rest of them when that is the case.
And I think the good news is that, as far as I'm aware, there aren't any hard court tournaments in Moscow the week before Wimbledon.
Bless.
One might pop up now, though.
Maybe it will.
It might just be Medvedev and then sort of wild cards going begging. Moscow won. It has just started getting light in Melbourne, David. The sun.
What a depressing moment.
The sun is rising. Goodness me. Does anybody have anything further to add about what we've seen tonight, this morning, earlier on today, whenever it might have been? Any further comments?
How big's the asterisk?
Non-existent.
Non-existent.
I hate the question. I understand why you've asked it. I was asked it on the telly this morning, but for me, non-existent.
For you, David?
I mean, look, ultimately, UB2 is in front of you, and he has no control over whether Novak Djokovic or Roger Federer or anybody else is in the draw. So ultimately, yeah, it's non-existent in terms of his achievement is his achievement, and there is no dilution of it as far as I'm concerned. I think I still I can't forget about it. I can't forget about it totally in the moment. I mean, 2 weeks ago, Novak Djokovic was deported. It's still, I can't believe that happened, but it did happen. And then a tennis tournament happened, and Rafael Nadal won it. And ultimately, that's the end.
Yeah, I see it as a factor, but an asterisk has such a negative connotation. It sort of is detracting from an achievement. It doesn't detract from Nadal's achievement for me at all.
Nadal losing to Söderling in 2009 was a massive factor in Federer completing the career slam. Absolutely. It is not an asterisk.
Yeah.
No, I agree. For me,
it's a similar situation.
Yeah.
I don't give Dominic Thiem an asterisk ultimately either. He won the tournament
that he was
tasked with winning.
Totally.
That's the end of it, really.
Yeah, and I think just to extend that Söderling at the French Open, I think Novak Djokovic's win at the French Open last year perhaps was an even greater achievement than his French Open in 2016 because he beat Nadal. Perhaps I think it elevates what he did, but it doesn't mean that his win in 2016 has an asterisk because Nadal pulled out of that tournament with a wrist injury,
and it doesn't mean that last year's French Open win has an asterisk because maybe Nadal's foot wasn't right.
Totally.
You know, I think, yeah, maybe it wasn't. But the guy still hung around with him so long that eventually Nadal physically faltered and Djokovic deservedly won that tournament. So, yeah, I mean, look, ultimately I agree. But I think it's right to raise it.
The women's doubles title was won about 400 years ago now by Barbora Krejcikova and Katerina Siniakova. They beat Beatrice Haddad-Meier and Anna Danilina 6-7, 6-4, 6-4. It was a brilliant match, actually. It was won on a Krejcikova moonball. If you get the opportunity to watch Match Point, then I would highly suggest doing so. It was brilliant. And now, just like Ash Barty, Krejcikova and Siniakova are a US Open away from completing a career slam. So
I wonder how they feel about the balls.
Must find out how they feel about the US Open balls. That'll be a priority for another time. Very quickly going to mention, because we didn't have time to yesterday. I mean, we don't really have time today. We're way over time, but I'm sure you'll understand why. We just don't want to go to bed, ever, apparently.
Well, speak for yourself.
The junior titles yesterday.
This one's allowed to go long.
I tell you this because, you know, it's useful to be able to say, oh, I know that name, you know, when they pop up beating somebody big in a few years' time or whenever it might be. The girls' title, both the titles, in fact, were won by the top seeds. The girls was won by the Croatian Petra Marchinko. She beat the Belgian Sofia Kostelas 7-5, 6-2. So relatively drama-free in the girls' final. Then there was the boys' final, which was anything but drama-free. Bruno Kuzuhara of the United States beat the Czech Jakub Menšík 7-6, 6-7, 7-5 in 3 hours and 43 minutes. And there was serious drama on Match Point, Matt. In fact, really distressing drama.
Yeah, in fact, throughout the latter stages of that final set, Menšík was really struggling physically, and you know, he wasn't able to serve before the shot clock had counted down, and that sort of thing. The umpire was having to give him time warnings and violations, which felt really sort of harsh, but that was just the rule because he was just hurting so much. And yeah, on Match Point, he double faulted and collapsed to the ground immediately. And Kuzuhara went straight round the other side of the net and checked he was okay. And then there was this extraordinary scene of Kuzuhara, lovely moment of sportsmanship, checking he was okay, and then sort of saluting the crowd to take the applause while they were bringing on a wheelchair for Menšík in the background and a sort of team of medics attending to him on the ground. It was, I mean, I've never seen anything like it, to be honest. And Menšík couldn't stay on court for the trophy ceremony post-match. He was just extraordinary, extraordinary scenes. And, you know, I think he's a great, great talent. So it was a real sort of shame that it finished in that way. And it's kind of a shame for Kusahara as well. But he gave a speech in English, obviously, and also in Japanese and in Portuguese, because he's got Japanese and Brazilian heritage.
You can imagine sort of agent. I mean, I'm sure he already has an agent, but that's the sort of thing that makes agents' eyes light up, isn't it? Marketable is the horrible word that would be used about somebody, somebody with appeal in different markets. I'm making it worse and more gross. Anyway, he seems a lovely lad. And yeah, names for the future, Marchinko and Kusuhara. And that, folks, I think is a wrap on the Australian Open 2022. It is just fully light outside our living room window. It's just the birds are chirping. The sun is about to poke through the clouds. It's all very weird. But if anything was going to send our body clock into total disarray, I'm very glad it was the experience that we had last night and in the very early hours of this morning. I will never forget it. And I'm glad that it was able to happen and extremely grateful to the friends of the podcast that made it happen. And I hope that our being here, as well as being tremendously fun for us, I won't pretend it hasn't been, but I hope it has elevated the listening experience for all of you as well. So thank you. And it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a pleasure to have Charlie as our Australian Open mascot. Charlie, we love you. You have done us proud. You're great. And just because you're no longer our mascot doesn't mean you can't continue to send us content. Please keep the content coming. Billie Jean watched the entirety of the match this evening. It kept her from going for a walk. In fact, my brother and his girlfriend Millie said they had to pull the curtain so she couldn't see what lovely walking weather it was outside. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. David, Matt and myself, we have mascots. We have Darwin. I have Carter. And Matt has Gerald the cat. Sorry, you have Darwin, David, not we. He's all yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have our two executive producers, Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner. They are both top blokes. And we have three final Australian Open shout-outs, Matt.
Yes, we have Norton Rappaport from San Diego, California.
Oh, I've been there.
Lovely.
Wow, what a name.
Yes, Norton has a beagle called, called Z.
Like Charlie?
Mm.
Oh, well, that's lovely. Is there a picture of Z?
We will request one.
Yes, okay.
Consider this the request,
yes,
Norton.
Please send us Z content, Norton. And thank you very much for your support.
Yeah.
We have Carolyn Koo from Somers, New York.
Hi, Carolyn.
Well, I've been to New York, but I've not. I assume that means New York State.
Yes.
How are we spelling Somers?
S-O-M-E-R-S, pronounced
Somers. Oh, she said. Oh.
Mm.
Interesting. Okay.
And Carolyn says, I've been a tennis fan since my dad took me to my first US Open in 1981. The first match I ever saw there was John McEnroe defeating Ramesh Krishnan in the quarterfinals, back when the old Louis Armstrong was the main stadium. The US Open is so much fancier now.
Mm. Yep. No notes. Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn.
And final shout out of the Australian Open is Kerry Ward from Canberra, who said lots of lovely things about the show, which I won't sort of impose on everyone. But she did say, I got a new poodle puppy, Leo, about the same time that Catherine got Billie Jean, and Leo always gives Billie Jean a woof if he hears her on the pod.
We love that.
Marvellous.
Kerry, please send Leo content. Animal content is encouraged with shout out detail. If that's not clear, then I don't know what I've been doing on these podcasts.
Any pics of Vigilac?
Yes, absolutely. So, Kerry, thank you very much. You are our final shout out of this 2022 Australian Open. It has been a wild, wild ride. We will be reflecting on the whole thing with the benefit of a tiny amount of hindsight and time to think about it all in our Australian Open review show, which will be available to friends of the Tennis Podcast. And that'll be up in the next couple of days. So look out for that. If you want to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, then the link to do so is in our show notes. If you just want to support us, if you just want to be in the gang, then it's absolutely worthwhile. I promise you, if you want to get yourself an intro or a shout out, those options are available too. And just before we go, there are a few people that we want to thank as well who have made this not only possible, but extremely pleasurable for us over the last few weeks. It takes an increasing number of people to make the Tennis Podcast happen, basically, and to grease the ever-thirsty wheels of the pod. And those people are Andrew and Hannah, that have just both done an absolutely stunning work with our Twitter. They are just gems, and we're so lucky to have them both. Patrick, who's always grumpy with me, but I know he loves me anyway. He has been doing our editing, and he is also, in his own special way, a gem. Gorana, obviously, is a gem. That's David's wife. Am I allowed to say that? But yeah. Also our lovely designer. And Woolley, Sarah Willand, who does all sorts of things for us, including giving Patrick aggro on my behalf in various WhatsApp groups. So much appreciated to Woolley and the whole team that makes it happen. I hope you've enjoyed this two-week circus of life. We'll speak to you all soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.